If you run a business large or small, get ready to take a lot of notes, because it's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. Host Yitzhak Saflis is off this week, and filling in for him are two former guests on the show, Bill O'Reilly and Jessica Proud, partners at the November Team, a New York-based communications firm.
Thanks for tuning in to Mind Your Business, the weekly radio show for business and marketing insights every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to midnight on 77 WABC Radio, 770 on your AM dial. I'm Bill O'Reilly. I'm joined here by Jessica Proud, and we're filling in for Mind Your Business host Yitzhak Saflis, who's off this week. Yitzhak, we hope not to mess up your show too much tonight. Mind Your Business is for all of you out there who dream of opening a business or already have one. And we want to, and if you want to hear from experts on how to market it, New York's a competitive place. It's a dog-eat-dog town, so we hope you'll tune in for the hour. Our first guest tonight is Matthew Glazier from the Glazier Group, one of New York's premier restaurant families. If you don't know the name of the family, you'll certainly know its restaurants, which include properties like Bridgewater's, Strip House in New Jersey, and, of course, Michael Jordan's, the Steakhouse, one of New York's best-known eateries. Matthew Glazier, welcome to Mind Your Business.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us that it's a dream of a lot of people to open a restaurant, but I'm sure it takes a lot. It's a lot harder than it sounds. What's some of your some advice you might have for someone thinking of opening one?
I think you have to start with a great location and go from there.
You certainly have one at Jordan's.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Grand Central Terminal is beautiful.
Yeah. It can't be cheap to do it. It is location on the restaurant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the back of that, like what makes it, you've been, Jordan's has been, what, 18 years now?
About 17 years,
about
yes.
17 years. And to be able to stay on top all that time, what does that take? It must take a bit of a lot of things.
I think it takes a lot of things. And especially in this business, you have to have a passion for the business and customer service. I think customer service and making sure you get up every day, doing the best you can, motivating your team to do the best they can every day. And then you either do a great job, or if you have a slip up, knowing you can get up tomorrow and try again to please people is a powerful motivator.
But I mean, even just surviving in New York as a restaurant seems to be a pretty big accomplishment. I read somewhere that about 80% of restaurants close in the first 5 years in New York. And of course, those that make it and become institutions like Michael Jordan's, the Steakhouse, are doing something right. How tough is the New York market?
Well, I think New York market is very tough. I think you have a very sophisticated consumer here. You have to make sure that you give them value for their dollar. Make sure you provide something that they can't get somewhere else, or else they're never going to come back. And I think a lot of restaurants don't differentiate themselves or provide something that these customers can't get somewhere else. And, you know, that makes it hard to succeed.
It's got to be tough, though, because you think, like with Jordan's, you want a consistency to the product and to the experience, but you also need to stay fresh. And in New York, restaurants are constantly turning over. There's you know, new vibes to restaurants that change with the times. How do you keep an institution going while also staying hip or fresh or on top?
Well, I think you hit a very good point when you said consistency. I think what we deliver there, Michael Jordan's Grand Central, is never going to be the latest restaurant. It's been open for 17 years. What we have to provide is a consistent experience for the guest so they know what they're having, and they can come back and have the exact same thing again and know it's going to be a wonderful dinner.
Now, how did you get into the restaurant business? Were you kind of weaned into it?
Well, you know, my parents had restaurants since I was an early teenager, and I actually went to law school and decided I like the restaurant business more than I like practicing law. But the older I get, the more law is involved in the restaurant business. So, it turned out to be a good education for this business.
I was going to say, in New York, you probably need a law license to run a restaurant. I
mean, it's very, very complicated.
Yeah, but, I mean, what should people expect if you open up the mom and pop place on the corner? Like, what do you have to do paperwork wise, insurance wise, health department wise, government wise? I mean, it's not that easy, is it?
Not easy at all, and it only gets harder. You know, you can give an example with the new healthcare laws. New healthcare laws. I'm a practicing attorney licensed in the state of New York, and it took me months to try to figure out what I had to do for my business, literally months. And I often sit and think there and go, imagine somebody who has one store, might not have the level of education, might just be starting out. How do they navigate all these regulatory hurdles. Universal healthcare is a wonderful idea, but implementing it on is very difficult.
I heard someone say, a small business owner a couple of years ago, that whenever a piece of mail comes from New York City or New York State, it's bad news. Like, you always know something's wrong. It's either a fine or a warning, or you've done something or haven't filed some paper. Now, what about the minimum wage discussion? The governor announced on Thursday that he intends to make the minimum wage $15 in New York State, which is almost more than twice the national minimum wage. How will that affect a place like Michael Jordan's and other small and smaller restaurants?
Well, we were preparing for the raise to fast food workers, which impacted stores of 30 or more. Last night I heard this when I was driving, and I understand that now they want to do it industry wide and not apply a tip credit, not industry wide, statewide for every industry, a $15 minimum wage. I think it levels the playing field, other than the way it was before, where it was just for certain sectors. But, I think it makes it very difficult for somebody who a year or two ago, did a business model, put down what they thought their wages were going to be for the next 5 years with the estimated growth. Now their payrolls are going to double, a lot quicker than they had planned.
And are you saying without a tip model, meaning that waiters and waitresses would now be paid $15 an hour? I mean, if that went through?
That would be my understanding, yes.
Yeah, I remember being a waiter, and I think I was paid $2.40 plus tips. And that's going to be a pretty decent job.
I feel like a lot of servers, though, might do better getting the tips than $15 an hour.
They'll still get the tips, though, right?
I don't know that's the answer.
Volunteer.
I think a lot of restaurants might go away, might change the model. They might go away. Now our waiters make $15 an hour. I think, it's a lot of things are going to shake out now, because people might say, if I'm paying my waiters $15 an hour, we're not going to have a tip-based model. And there are several restaurants around the country now that refuse tips, that don't allow tips.
That's actually very interesting. You could end up with kind of a European, restaurant model where you pay $20 an hour or $25 for good waiters. That could change a lot of things.
It's going to be very interesting. I mean, it will be very interesting to see the way it shapes up.
I mean, you have a number of properties in the city. You're obviously well established as a restaurateur. But does this new policy make you think twice about maybe opening up another restaurant?
Yes and no. But, real estate in New York is so expensive already as it is. When you think about things like healthcare, like increased minimum wage, it's hard to think of each one individually. Because at the end of the day, it all takes a bite out of one pie. So it's more when you put all these things together. So when you think, and this I just heard about, because this really was just announced with Vice President Biden, but, they haven't really said how long they're going to extend out the implementation phase. I think it makes it more difficult to do business, but I also think people are going to change the way they do business, that instead of, people working 40-hour weeks, people are going to be more acutely managing their hourly workers, so that people might be working 32 hours a week. I think that it's going to impact the worker some way, where they might get less hours. People might spend more money into automation. You already see it in California, where McDonald's is doing that. So, and it's not a bad thing. People deserve to get a wage in which they can provide for their family.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about automation, because I saw that McDonald's is now doing kiosks rather than human beings at the counters. Right, at some locations, particularly in the high minimum wage states, is there a day where you foresee a screen at a table where you tap your order, rather than have a waiter or waitress come over? Is that something that's on the horizon, or do you think that's pretty far down the road?
I really don't think it's down that far down the road. We just put in a new point-of-sale system in Jordan's less than a year ago that was all iPads, iPad-based and Wi-Fi-based. So, right now you have the technology with these iPads or I'm sure other tablets where you can almost they do it at Delta Terminal
at LaGuardia.
Yeah. You sit there, it's chained there, they bring you your food, and I don't think it's so far away at all.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how much things have changed. I mean, also in New York, I mean, even with all the difficulties of operating a restaurant, the number of permits going out have never been higher from what I've read. I read that about 25,000 restaurant permits are now out there in New York City, including many, many in Brooklyn. That's really exploded. Have you seen, like, how much have you seen the industry change in your years in the business?
It's changed a lot. I mean, it definitely costs more money to open up a restaurant when you just look at your acquisition costs, like the real estate, the lease, but the building, the build-out construction is very expensive in New York right now. And you've definitely seen, you know, a migration to Brooklyn and to other areas that, you know, 10, 15 years ago weren't hot. So
does that demand that the product be better, that there will always be better quality?
I think, you know, when you have so much competition, it's very interesting. You don't look at anybody's competition because everybody's your competition. So you got to kind of be internally motivated to do the best you can do because there's so much competition.
Yeah. It's amazing. I think Michael Jordan's came. You seem to be the first of the new steakhouses that came to New York. I mean, steak seemed to be on the way out, and then Jordan's opened and it exploded.
Yeah, I mean, in 1994, you know, it was a different world, you know, back then.
Yeah, everyone was afraid of it, and then everyone went protein happy. You know,
and it keeps on going, which is remarkable.
It does. What about the change in? I mean, it used to be if you got a good Zagat rating, that helped you a lot. Now with all the online, you know, Yelp and all the other type of you know, online ranking services, does that make a big difference for a restaurant? Do they really matter?
I think they do. I think you know, we read it every morning, and we circulate every morning any feedback we get, positive or negative.
Wow.
I think, and you get real time feedback. People, you know, I think in this world, when you're upset, you're more likely to write, you know, a quick review than somebody's happy. So, you know, we read them and we try to take action on them. You know, the one thing I read more and put more weight to is the open table reviews, because open table will have to be somebody who actually dined in the restaurant. Sometimes, you know, it could be the friend of a ex-employee that writes something on Yelp. I mean, you never really, there's no way to guarantee that person actually was there, but an open table, they had to have dined there to actually leave the feedback.
Yeah, talk about a change. I mean, just the changing reservation system in the last, you know, 10 years.
Yeah,
I mean, it's got to be. I mean, your phone's not, I guess, ringing off the hook as much, but it's all happening automatically.
And there's, I mean, one thing, there is a cost. I mean, open table, that becomes a big part of your cost in the restaurant.
Do you get a lot of bookings through open table?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I like to use it.
I use it.
My wife, who, you know, in a positive way, changes reservations all the time, and it's much easier than calling to just change it.
Especially when you're last minute, which yeah. I always am.
I'd always be too embarrassed to change your reservation, but not with open table.
Yeah, you know, change it. We did it last week. I thought I was working late, changed it later. Then I'm like, oh, I'll get out early. Made it earlier. You know, it's convenient.
Great, Matt. We're going to take a little commercial break, and then we'll be back with Matthew Glazier of the Glazier Group. You're listening to the 77 WABC. Be right back.
Your company website is crucial to your success, providing information about your services and programs. It has to deliver just the right message, the right way, to make customers excited about what you offer and interested in working with you. Online, you have to be on the money to make the money. So go with the best, Website with Brains. Their experienced team will plan, write, design, and program a winning website that combines simplicity and flexibility with powerful features that will make you the king of content marketers. And they make it so easy. All of their websites are made with an easy, user-friendly interface. Website with Brains will have your new website up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. Take control of your online marketing today. Call Website with Brains for a free consultation and see how they can improve your online presence. 1-800-WEB-9018. That's 1-800-WEB-9018. Or visit them online at websitewithbrains.com.
Welcome back to Mind Your Business on 77 WABC. I'm Bill O'Reilly, and I'm joined by Jessica Proud. And we're talking to Matthew Glazier of the Glazier Group, which runs a number of restaurants, including Michael Jordan's, the steakhouse at Grand Central Station. Matt, we talked about people dreaming of open restaurants, and I'm sure of opening restaurants. And I'm sure there are some listeners tonight that have always wanted to do it or are considering doing it or know someone who's been out there. There's something about restaurants that's owning a restaurant that's really alluring to a lot of people. I think at least it is to me. If you were to sit down or they were to sit down and draw up a list of pros and cons, the pros of owning a restaurant, being in that business, and the cons, what would you tell them to put in each column?
Well, I think I'd call it cons and pros. I think I'd put the cons first.
You are in New York, huh?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about, you know, you think of yourself as a fireman in a lot of ways, and that's kind of my first con. There's always a problem, and you always got to put out the fire. And it really is a 24/7 business, and you really have to dedicate your life to it in a lot of ways. You know, your busiest times are when other people have off. You know,
that's something I was going to ask. I mean, you're really married to your restaurants. I mean, isn't that right? I mean, I know you have a law degree, so you're dealing with a lot of the regulatory stuff, but you're also, you know, fixing seats and working on, you know, disputes in the kitchen and, you know, where's the booze? I mean, like, you know, all those, there's so many details I would imagine in your industry. You are 24/7.
It's absolutely 24/7. Absolutely. And, you know, what can go wrong will go wrong. I almost look at every day you're putting on a play, and you got, you know, the stage is the front of the house, and, you know, the back of the house is backstage. And, you know, every day, you know, you're dealing with the waiters or the actor. You know, you're putting out a performance every night. And then when the customers leave, there's a lot of work still to be done, and there's also a lot of work before they arrive.
And how important is it to have the right staff, to have the right wait staff? I mean, certainly, you know, you want the right chefs, but in the front of the house, how important is it to have the right people out there?
Yeah, I think it's very, very important. They're the ones who interact with your customers. It's not me. I'm not, you know, unless I'm there and there's an issue, or, you know, I'm not the one interacting with my customers. It's the waiters, and they're on the front lines.
Do you get a lot of turnover in New York?
Actually, less than you think. Good people stay. But, you know, like maybe that 15-20% turns over every year. You know, I have people for 16, 17 years, a lot of people for a long time. But then, you know, there's a certain percentage that's transient. But, you know, it is people, you know, it's a career, you know.
Now, what about, we talked about some of the cons. What would be in the pro column? Like, what's the upside to opening a restaurant?
Well, if your passion's pleasing people, it's a way to pursue your passion. I mean, if you succeed, it can be profitable. I think a lot of couples work together and, you know, do a mom and pop restaurant where, you know, one's the front of the house, one's the back of the house. And if you can work with your spouse or, you know, it's an opportunity to work together, and you can build something. I think a lot of people, that's one of the skills they believe they have is cooking or, you know, service. And, you know, they want to go into that business. I don't want to say, you know, maybe 15 years ago you would have set a low barrier to entry cost-wise, but I don't think that's the case anymore.
It just seems so hard. I mean, restaurants are such a – or I guess restaurant crowds are so transient. I remember working for a restaurant in my early 20s, and the thought was, please, dear God, don't have someone from the New York Times review it because the review might be good. And the fear was that people would come in flocks, and then the restaurant would be burned out, and then everybody would go to the next hot place. And, I mean – not a lot of businesses have that problem, but restaurants certainly do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes you got to be careful what you wish for when there's positives and negatives to every review. And some people say certain stars are the kiss of death, and not in a bad, you know, 3 stars could be the kiss of death, and 2 stars are a home run. I mean, it depends. Yeah.
Is it really true that restaurant reviewers will show up in a, you know, fake nose and a cap or, you know, a blonde wig?
I think that was more the case maybe a little while ago, but I still think they try to go incognito and use aliases and stuff like that. So,
well, it's interesting because, you know, obviously in New York you could go to a different restaurant every night for years and never hit the same place twice. But I know as a New Yorker myself, I always find myself going back to places that I know I get good service and I get good food and I will be a repeat customer.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's such a, you know, it is expensive to go out. And, you know, you guys were able to do well through the recession and everything. So do you feel like you have some repeat customers? I mean, even in Grand Central Station, which is a madhouse all the time.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I kind of look at it as we have two different constituencies of customers, which during the day is businessmen and women having lunch who work nearby. And, you know, I walk in there and I have to say hi to, not have to, I want to say hi to 4 or 5 tables every day. I mean, literally, we have the same people sitting there every day. At night, during the week, a lot of the same thing. But on the weekend is touristy and, you know, people want to see Grand Central. And so that's less of a repeat business. That's more special occasion on the weekends or people from out of town.
What's the best – sorry, I was just going to ask you. What is the best thing that you could hear from a customer about their experience?
Can I make a reservation for next week, I think? That kind of puts the proof in the pudding, right?
What can somebody expect if they're going to open a restaurant? What can they expect to pay in rent? I mean, I know New York City rents are so high. I remember Danny Meyer's Union Square Cafe closed because the rents had approached $650,000 a year. I know WD-50, same experience. But for the average mom-and-pop restaurant, I know that it's tough to get an average because you could be a place in Brooklyn or Queens or Staten Island would be very different than Midtown Manhattan.
Not as much as you would think, by the way.
Really?
Not as much as you would think.
So what would somebody expect to pay if I wanted to open a – just rough figures. If I wanted to open a 20-table restaurant.
That would be a very small and economically difficult restaurant to do. Hmm. But how would you say 20 tables or 20 seats?
20 tables.
20 tables. Okay, so 20 tables. I'm sorry. I thought you said 20 seats. I think you got to pay between $20,000 and $30,000 a month in rent.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, depending on – that's probably got to be – 3,000 to 4,000 square feet, and I mean,
so how much money would you want to start with in reserve? That, you know, you're opening a restaurant, nobody knows about it yet. You're trying to market it, which I'd love to talk to you about in a second. You know, you've got someone outside in the sandwich board, and you're paying rent at the same time. Like you've got to sell a lot of chicken Caesar salads to.
Absolutely.
$30,000 a month.
Absolutely.
So do you need to – I mean, does a New York restaurant owner need to have $1 million in the bank before
right.
they do it?
But that's not – so that's rent. I mean, you also have to build it out. You know, you have to inventory. You have to get inventory. And then when you start talking about – so let's talk about fixed costs, and we can talk about marketing and stuff like that. But insurance is not inexpensive. So, you know, liability insurance, all that stuff, your workman's comp, all, you know, all that stuff, and then your payroll. So – you know, and plus, you probably want your occupancy cost to you know, not be that big a number. But yeah, you really have no choice. And where I was alluding to about outer boroughs, I've looked in space in Brooklyn that's more expensive than space in New York, in Manhattan. And you know, so it's a tough decision. Do you want to be in Brooklyn for that money, or do you want to be in downtown Manhattan for that money?
Do you have to expect that you're not going to turn a profit for the first number of years?
You know, every time we look at doing a space, we do very conservative budgets. And, you know, we really look at, you know, what's the worst case scenario for the first year, and then what's the bottom line under the worst case scenario. And my father and I often have many discussions about where I'm like, oh, you're too conservative. But, you know, we really kind of want to know what that break-even point is. We want to know if it doesn't go, what we're dealing with and what it costs to open the door every day. And that kind of goes back towards those labor costs. So if I did projections 6 months ago with the understanding of that minimum wage was X dollars, that budget just went out the window and I could have signed a lease in that meantime. And, you know, and the assumptions I made are totally different.
So you want continuity. You want to know what your fixed costs are going to be, if possible.
I think, while labor is not a fixed cost, minimum wage in your mind should be at least predictable.
Yeah, I'm adding up all the costs. I'm thinking about insurance for the kitchen. I mean, there's a lot of fire back there. You've got a lot of things adding up.
And the cost of our goods range from, you know, 30% to 40% of our sales. It's right. You know, you sell a steak for $50, that steak probably costs you $25-$30 now.
Yeah. Is that right? That's amazing.
Yeah.
On the wholesale side.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. You must have to have a real love for this business to be in it. Obviously people do. I mean, it's Michael Jordan's has made it. I mean, you are so, I mean, established. And you have great foot traffic, and I'm sure you pay for that. I won't ask you what your rents are, but they can't be small. But to the love that it would take to get to a point like that really is pretty extraordinary.
Well, yeah. You know, luck and hard work, I think.
So how do you market a restaurant? So you've taken the plunge. You tapped your Aunt Nellie and your friends from childhood, and everybody kicked in some money, and you've opened the door and put the sign on the door. How do you get people in the door?
You hire professionals. I recently had this conversation. So, you know, it's not just now. There's not just food press. There's lifestyle press. You know, when we do an opening and when we maintain our business, we have a public relations firm. that does that. We have specialists in social media who manage, you know, our Facebook account, do our Twitter, you know, and do some of that interaction on Yelp and some of the other things we were talking about.
I actually work with the public relations firm that I know that you work with, Nicholas and Lentz Communications, that does a lot of New York City restaurants. Christine Nicholas was the head of NYC and Company, which is the city's travel and tourism arm. And so they do lots of different restaurants and events and venues. So you certainly picked a good one there. But for someone with a very small budget, do you go online now? Do you do Facebook ads? Do you pay someone to run up and down the street?
I don't know if I do Facebook ads, but I make sure I have a very robust Facebook presence and make sure that I engage with my customers in the way that they like to be engaged. Make it definitely your web page mobile friendly. I don't know if ads matter. I'm sure they do. I just personally don't have experience with Facebook ads.
And getting back to the person that's contemplating opening a place, the rap years ago was always you've got to watch your staff because there's a lot of cash in the business. Is that really no longer the case with everything is credit cards now?
There are a lot of ways you can get burned by your staff. There is from common theft of stealing product to giving it away. I like to believe that my staff doesn't do that, but we train our managers to keep an eye out for it. I think a common number in the business is that you have to basically pencil in 3% for slippage.
Is that right?
I would like to believe that's not the case. But, for example, a bartender could give a customer a drink and not ring it in the computer and might get a better tip. In my mind, that's theft. In the bartender's mind, that might not be theft. But, I'm sure stuff like that, does happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually kind of interesting. I mean, can you pull back the curtain? Like, what do you train people to look for? How do you spot that?
Well, it's called spotters. I mean, you pay people to come in and they sit at the bar and they watch and they actually send you a report and they either do it not just for theft, but they'll do it for you provide them with your steps of service and they'll let you know. They'll do a whole report. The scallops were missing, the whatever, and they'll give you a whole report. And they do that for theft as well.
Could you ever do like an undercover boss where you went in incognito?
I think I'd have to have like a Fu Manchu or a mustache or something to get away with that.
Okay, one last important question for Matthew Glazier of the Glazier Group. Buybacks at bars, they still exist? I remember New York tried to ban them about 20 years ago and people went crazy. But is that something that's still an established practice in the restaurant business?
Absolutely.
Three gets you four?
Not that established. I think what we try to teach our staff, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier, if you want to buy somebody a drink, talk to the manager and make sure it's the business's decision, not the individual bartender's decision.
Yeah. Well, Matt, I got to say thank you so much on behalf of Jessica and me. I mean, you know an awful lot about restaurants. It is an industry that's growing, that is very difficult. And the fact that you and the Glazier Group are able to succeed year after year is pretty remarkable in a city like New York. So thank you for being a guest.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Mind Your Business on 77 WABC Radio. I'm Jessica Proud, joined with Bill O'Reilly. And when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Alex Gold, co-founder of Traction.
Your company website is crucial to your success. Providing information about your services and programs, it has to deliver just the right message, the right way, to make customers excited about what you offer and interested in working with you. Online, you have to be on the money to make the money. So go with the best. Website with Brains. Their experienced team will plan, write, design, and program a winning website that combines simplicity and flexibility with powerful features that will make you the king of content marketers. And they make it so easy. All of their websites are made with an easy, user-friendly interface. Website with Brains will have your new website up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. Take control of your online marketing today. Call Website with Brains for a free consultation and see how they can improve your online presence. 1-800-WEB-9018. That's 1-800-WEB-9018. Or visit them online at websitewithbrains.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Mind Your Business. I'm Jessica Proud, and I'm joined by Bill O'Reilly. As we said at the top of the hour, this show really helps to give you invaluable insight on how to start a business or take it to the next level through expert marketing strategies. And tonight's guest is none other than an expert marketer himself who has truly revolutionized the online marketing industry, Alex Gold. Alex is the co-founder of Traction, a marketing technology company, and he really landed on the startup scene with a big bang, being named one of the top startup companies to watch. He was nominated for a Cannes Lion Award. He's been profiled in Forbes. And Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
And I think you just had a piece in Inc., didn't you?
I did. Just today we had an article come out in Inc. magazine. We've been doing a lot of business overseas in Singapore, and we featured some of our partners and customers as well as some of our investors there. Singapore has been an interesting critical link between us. We're a Silicon Valley-based company in San Francisco and Southeast Asia, and Singapore has been an entrepot for us to work in a really valuable market.
Nice.
And we saw that and did a profile.
That's great. So, Alex, let's just get right into it. Explain to us, like you would explain to an elementary school student, what exactly your company does. Peel back the curtain for us.
Totally. So every company or any business that sells a product or service to consumers needs marketing, and that's what we do. So think of us as an on-demand marketing expert. So there's different buckets of marketing online in the digital space. One could be search engine optimization. That's, you know, ensuring that when somebody searches for your product or service on Google, that your result, your company will appear at the top. We can connect them or any business with an expert in that field. Another one is content marketing, so doing articles and features on whatever your product or services are. We can connect people with a content marketing expert or a number of publishers. And we do this all automatically. We have a platform that's 1, 2, and 3 easy steps. All you do is enter who you're trying to reach, what your target budget is, and then we set a number of marketing experts on that. So think of this as a curated version of an Elance or an Odesk. And automated entirely all every step of the way.
Alex, let me try and understand. So you're saying if you're a business owner kicking off and you're looking to reach a certain demographic, is that your that's what you mean by target audiences? And you put in your is it actually an online site or people work with your team?
Yeah. So we operate as a marketplace business. So to back up a little bit here, we realize that today, trying to do online marketing or trying to start an online marketing campaign is this Byzantine effort. You have no idea what you're doing if you're a small or medium-sized business. And what we try to do is really pull back that curtain and make it super easy. So on one side of our platform and our marketplace, we have over 8,000 marketing experts across different fields. And we've cut the time. You have to go before to a small little agency or a small little shop and for different functions. We can start a campaign in 15 minutes. We cut the time for businesses to do that. All they have to do, the first thing they come onto our platform, it's a completely digital solution, and enter their information. So the demography and the psychography of who they're trying to reach, so age, gender, geographic location, specifically let's say you want to reach females 18 to 25 in the New York State or tri-state area, we can very easily do that. And then our system will automatically and algorithmically, using our unique technology, connect them with the marketing experts that are specialists in reaching their specific demographic. Before, it would take months to do this. Now you can get started in about 15 minutes.
Wow.
It's really using technology to disrupt traditional agency services in the space.
Yeah, and you really did revolutionize how brands were marketing online. How did you get those big brands like Dove and Revlon and General Mills? How did you get them to trust you with this new model?
Great question. So you start small. Most of our brands have actually come inbound to us. So my background before starting this company is I worked in business development, marketing, and distribution with a film studio called Boogaroo, which was started by Michael Eisner after he left the Walt Disney Company, where he was CEO for over 20 years. And a lot of the relationships with large brands that we had there were able to parlay into initial test campaigns on our platform. But those are initial, and they start at, you know, $5,000, $10,000. But once you prove results, and especially that you're engaging in very ROI-driven marketing, it'll scale up to, you know, multitude of times that, so 7 to 10 times a very small test budget. And most of our business, if not all of our business, has actually been inbound. So we're working with over 200 different customers now, work with over 80 Fortune 500 companies. The rest are more medium-sized or small enterprises. Those range from startups in my space, in my field, down to, let's say, like Rhino Linings, which is an $80 million a year spray-on truck bed lining company based in San Diego. So it runs the gamut of different verticals and sectors. Our focus has been so far on consumer products. So we work with Unilever, we work with Procter & Gamble, we work with a number of other consumer products companies, ConAgra, for instance, as well as entertainment. So we work with AMC Networks as well as Sony Pictures Entertainment. So those have been our two verticals of focus. We've been scaling and expanding now as well.
Alex, I'm 52 years old and I'm feeling very ancient. I mean, the way I was kind of raised, there were three disciplines here. There was public relations, there was advertising, and there was marketing. And now it sounds like the three have really merged to an extent. You used the word disruptive in what you said, and that's the word that struck me. Disruptive to agencies. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Like, do you see those three disciplines merging into one?
Well, I think there's a large transformation occurring and happening right now that's really interesting. And what we're seeing is that agencies are proving value, but in a very different way. You have the traditional, you know, the creative revolution of an ad agency in the 1960s, the Mad Men style, you know, creative big idea coming out. That will always occur. That will always happen. That's a very human process. High-level strategy as well is also very critical. And you see actually, you know, more consulting firms like a McKinsey or a Bain capital moving into high-level brand strategy and consulting. I think this traditional silo definition is breaking down a little bit, where PR agencies are now doing more media buying or planning, meaning they're making buys for brands and advertisers on TV, on digital channels as well. You know, marketing agencies are moving more into more the ad agency camp. And what's happening is you're seeing specialists across different verticals that have a full gamut of services. So, for instance, you know, on our platform, we have experts in search engine optimization or in pay-per-click marketing, meaning getting people to click on a page. They can work across a number of different disciplines in PR, you know, in more traditional advertising, but they're experts, let's say, in search engine optimization at one vertical, and they can work with any different type of business on that. So you're just seeing a readjustment and realignment. We work with a lot of agencies, and for them, it's great because with us, they get to save a lot of money and time that they would spend before trying to look for qualified experts. It's just using technology to optimize the process and really cut down on lag and lead time to start a campaign.
Did you ever experience like blowback from those industries? Like, did you always know it would be successful, this new model, or did you feel at one point that maybe the status quo would strongly be in place?
Well, I think any company that is looking, especially a technology company that is looking at doing something different, is going to face certain challenges from established industry incumbents. Right?
I'd be looking over your shoulder, looking for someone named Edelman or any of those guys.
Well, look at Uber, right? Uber's a great example, right? Uber has come in and completely redefined what it means to, you know, be a taxi or limousine service. But, you know, that's another great example. Airbnb is another company that are challenging in many ways hotels and traditional lodging services. So when you put traction in that space, yes, of course, at the beginning, you know, there was some, as you said, looking over the shoulder. But actually, we work very well with agencies. Because for them, and especially a PR firm or a media buying firm, it's great for them to save time and money because most of the time they're actually contracting this out to vendors anyways. And they're doing this through an extremely manual, very tedious process. So some of our advisors to the company and organization are actually some of the largest executives of some of the largest ad agency holding networks in the world because they want to be a part of this. And, you know, agencies understand their own business just as well as, you know, anyone in the space. So we're just cutting down on lead time and lag time. And the same thing that, you know, Uber in many ways works with taxi services. They work on a local level. They work with limousine services. They brought everybody into their platform. We try to be as inclusive as possible.
So with that said, where is this going over the next 5 or 10 years? What's next?
Forget the crystal ball.
Exactly.
If anyone would know, you would.
Exactly right. My investors ask the exact same questions, like, where do you want to grow? Where do you want to build this into a company? You know, we're a little over a year old. You know, we're closing in on 40 people now in the company. We have offices in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and we're opening, just opened one in New York as well. And, you know, on the heels of the Singapore article today, I hope to expand throughout Southeast Asia as well. Where we see the company going and where we see marketing going is two separate questions. For us, we just want to continue driving as much value for our partners as possible.
You know, it's amazing. When I was growing up, we used to laugh at math majors. And now the math majors are all multimillionaires.
They're ruling the world.
I mean, the algorithms, like, how does that happen? Like, how, do you sit down with a pencil and paper? I mean, like how do they do it? Like, seriously.
No, that's a great question. So my co-founder, he's a math and engineering major from Columbia.
I'm not laughing at him.
He runs the tech side of the company. It's really looking at it as a data taxonomy. So everything that we do is very data-driven. We ingest over 1,700 different data points on every single click that is actually recorded or the transaction is recorded on our platform. And then that's just all taxonomized. So we have an entire team of engineers. I mean, the company is mostly engineering-driven, and we have four data scientists on the team that handle that. We have two algorithms that power what we do. And it's really just multivariate analysis and testing that powers any algorithm.
And is the basic idea just to have your messaging or your brands in front of people wherever they go? Is that essentially the idea?
The goal is to, you know, lead consumers into somewhat of a purchase funnel or some sort of conversion funnel. So some businesses, if it's more localized business, you know, SEO or search engine optimization and pay-per-click marketing may work better. But, for instance, let's give an example of the work we've done with Hellmann's, which is the Unilever mayonnaise brand. We distribute thousands of recipes that feature Hellmann's as the choice product within those recipes to different publications to give people quick and easy meal ideas on the way home. So it's reaching consumers at different stages of the funnel that's appropriate for them. And based upon the input that our brands and advertisers give us on the platform, our system will then automatically connect them with the marketers best able to achieve their needs.
So it's a lot of creative thinking along with the algorithm. It's not just a simple mathematical thing.
Yeah, and that's actually a great point. And that's the interesting thing about this is that we are actually, at our core, we're a marketplace business. We're a marketplace of skilled services, right, that's technology-enabled. So the key component here is that we still require all of our marketers, our skilled marketers on the other side, to make the judgment and value call. We just use technology to speed up the process, track all of the data, and then try to optimize as much as possible.
It really is so fascinating. I have to ask you, what compelled you to do this?
That's a great question. Yeah. I was a marketer myself, and I was promoting TV series, on platforms like Netflix, Hulu, AOL, and I couldn't find in a good amount of time a skilled marketer to go and perform a campaign for me. This was my personal struggle, and my co-founder was also having a similar experience. We've been friends for a very long time. We're actually living the Silicon Valley dream. We're actually roommates in San Francisco, in addition to being co-founders of the company. So we're really in that milieu, shall I say. But it was my experience, and I started interviewing a lot of other people in my space in entertainment and film marketing, and it turns out that a lot of other people were having the same challenge. And I said, well, this could be a business. So I figured I was young. I was 26 at the time, and why not go and start your own company and do it? And here I am, knock on wood.
Which is obviously doing very well.
It's amazing. I mean, who can afford this type of marketing? I mean, Is it scalable? Like, say, for example, you go home and you set up a hooch distillery in your basement.
Yeah.
You come up with the best licorice vodka or, you know, whatever it is, Hawaiian punch vodka. You used to put it on the back of your, kid's wagon and roll it around town and see if you could sell it. But can a small startup like that afford real marketing talent?
If it's spiked punch, the Department of the Treasury may have a problem.
Hawaiian pinch.
A funny story, actually, this interesting case study is that one of the companies that we worked with at the beginning was one of my friend's startups, and to start and to create a campaign, he created this fake vodka campaign around it, very similar to what you did. So to use that as a case in point, actually, just exactly right along the lines of your thinking, there's no minimum spend. So if you're a small business and you're a localized small business, you can spend, $15, $20 a day, not even. If you're a large company like a Unilever or a Yahoo who we work with, you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. It's all dependent upon what the scale and what the needs of your business are. And that's the flexibility that the technology really provides, is a trackability and, again, no minimum spending. A flexibility is really critical for a lot of our partners.
Yeah, maybe we should try that for our business.
Well, I think at a risk-free proposition, you know, a lot of our campaigns, you know, are done on a cost per click or a cost per acquisition basis. So many of our partners actually drive, you know, not only ROI-driven marketing, but it's actually ROI-positive. So they're actually, in some cases, making money on the campaigns that they're working with us on.
So you took on this really Herculean effort and obviously are being recognized for all of your successes. But what advice would you give to someone out there that's thinking about a startup or starting their own business?
Don't.
Are you out of your mind?
Yeah. Stay in the boring office job. Enjoy it. No, I think there's kind of three things normally when I'm asked this question is that, you know, make sure you have a very defined idea of what you want to do. And, you know, it costs very little now to start a company. You can incorporate in Delaware for like $80. You have to pay a little bit of franchise tax fee, but it's very inexpensive. You get Amazon Web Services for hosting, and then you get a WordPress layout. You can basically start a company for now $150, and you're in business. So the barriers to entry have been lowered so much, but because of that, I think people have to be very refined in their idea of specifically very narrowly what they want to go after and what they want to do. So be very, very granular, and don't be scared within that to test different variations and to spend, you know, a different amount of money on testing. I like to say multivariate or A/B testing is the heart of any great startup or any great growth engineer who works with startup companies. And that's, you know, that's what's powered companies like Twitter and Pinterest. They just experimented across different business models. So be very refined with your idea, but then experiment within that and know what it is. The second one is, you know the amount of time and space that you're going to need to do it. You know, when I started my company, I thought, oh, I'm going to still have the same normal working hours. I'm going to still have the same schedule. I'm going to be able to see my girlfriend. I'm going to be able to see my family. Hell no. It's your mistress, your lover, your closest family member. And, you know, it helped that my co-founder and I were roommates because literally we worked 24/7. And it really, really helps. And the third one I'd be really, really critical on this one is get a co-founder. Get somebody who can share the load with you that has different interests and sets than you. You know, in the company, I handle the business, operations, legal side. I'm an attorney by trade before this. And the interesting thing is that, you know, my co-founder, he handles the engineering, product, and data science of the company. If it was both of us, we totally butt heads. But because we have different skill sets and subsets, we actually work really well together. And we actually have been able to propel and grow the company in a really good way. So those are the three pieces of advice I would do. And you don't need to be in Silicon Valley. You don't need to be in San Francisco to start a great company. There are great companies all over the U.S. And all over the world. And, you know, New York is an amazing area. Silicon Valley in New York is really coming up now. We have amazing companies in New York. You know, Chicago's scene as well is also really good.
I've got to say, speaking of amazing, I've just been amazed by the millennial generation. That just there's so many young people who have the guts to start businesses and really complex businesses. I mean, it maybe that's just a byproduct of a lousy economy where people are forced to be entrepreneurs. But I mean, how do you keep your head from exploding? I mean, I just went to Iceland. I used Airbnb for the first time with my family. We traveled all around. It was so seamless, and you'd think that this existed for for a millennial itself. It was just it's already so established or Uber. And when I started to, you start to think of the possible new applications for that type of cooperative world that's possible because of this online world that you've been raised in. How do you start? I mean, your mind just must explode every day.
I think maybe it's naivete, to be honest.
no, that's, you're doing it.
That's a big part of it. You know, I think that you know, it's I don't know if it's generational because. You know, there was a longitudinal study done on when the most successful entrepreneurs are to start a company in different age ranges. And really, it's this myth of the 21-year-old Stanford computer science or symbolic systems dropout who, you know, is emulating Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, Lucas Duplan who, you know, started a company called Klinkle, which kind of is in dire straits now. But that's kind of the pattern matching idea. The truth is the archetypal founder looks a lot like Travis Kalanick. Who is the founder and CEO of Uber. Travis Kalanick is, you know, a little bit under 40, I think he's 38, 39 now, has had a few successes under his belt already, seasoned entrepreneur, fierce fighter, very, very, very well-driven executive, knows how to manage people, be accountable. So there's this myth, I think, that, and the most of the successful companies that have been started by, you know, entrepreneurs in the 35 to 45 range. So there's this myth of the archetypal millennial entrepreneur that, you know, is somewhat bewildered by this space and creates a beautiful and brilliant product. I think what it also really is, to be honest, is the lack of barriers to entry now. But, you know, to start, as I said, an online platform, it's so cheap. One of, you know, a large Silicon Valley investor named Paul Graham coined this term called ramen profitability, where, you know, you can be profitable for a one- or two-person company on a few thousand dollars a month and then just scale and grow from there. And I think that has made it an avenue for a lot of millennials to go and try their own companies or their own applications. But I always say this to people as well, and you're totally on the right track here. Your mind does explode when you see the possibilities and potential. We've just scratched the surface. This is a different point. I was having this conversation the other day with another entrepreneur. We've just scratched the surface when it comes to the possibilities of what you're referring to with Airbnb, the sharing economy. And now we're moving more into connected devices or what people are calling the Internet of Things. So how does our entire universe, every object that we have in some way become connected and as a data tool? And that's where a lot of the more gripping startups are now. A lot of the ones that you're working with are web-based services, the software. But where I'm seeing really cool new companies is in hardware or in moonshot ideas like fusion power or AIDS vaccines.
And all those things need to be marketed.
Every single thing needs to be marketed. Like, this is a universal service, everything that we do. You know, like this is, and that's I think why there was a need for it.
I just had one last question. I mean, we mentioned Uber, and one of their executives have actually been a guest on the show before.
Oh, wow.
But with all of these changes, do you think, in your expert opinion, that our leaders in government have a full grasp on both the assets? I know that's kind of a crazy question, but I'd love to know your thoughts about that, about both the assets and the liabilities that can come along with technology.
So I'll give you a good case in point, and more challenged case in point. You know, one area that where you know entrepreneurs are very, very and investors, venture capitalists have a lot of gripe on is on immigration in the United States. A few years ago, there was the Startup Visa Act that's kind of stalled. The Jobs Act didn't really, you know, pan out. It's been held up by the SEC for a while. I think what's really interesting is that the government has, you know, been very slow to act. We have a dire need for talented engineers and computer science majors from around the world. And in a globalized economy, these are individuals that are going to be able to go and find a position in other countries. And this is actually detrimentally impacting the U.S. in our competitive global standing. So fixing immigration is really critical. I'm desperate to hire engineers. I can't hire enough. And if you ask that of any entrepreneur, you know, of any technology-based company, they'll say that. Other case, so that's one area where I think, you know, we can have some challenges that need to be fixed. The other area where I think, you know, government is actually very receptive or protective is, you know, in terms of what a 1099 independent contractor is. You know, marketplace companies, you know, like, let's say, Uber or Candy, which is an on-demand cleaning service, right? You know, are they replacing services that would be traditionally a full-time employee or W-2 and turning it into a 1099 or an independent contractor? And that's an area where government and the legal system has actually been very, very keen to respond to and protect employee rights. So I think that it's a double-edged sword. I think what people really need to do is really bridge a gap between Washington and the technology industry in Silicon Valley. It's kind of this, you know, two alien planets with each other in some way. Same thing could be said of Hollywood and Silicon Valley, but that's an entirely different discussion. That's kind of a massive opportunity, I think, and no one's really exploiting that. And some of the campaigns that have, you know, been created, like 4.us around that space, you know, could be doing better. And that's the complete area that I think needs a lot of work, just connecting and combining minds and ideas.
That is so informative, Alex. Thank you so much. You've been a great guest. We're really happy to have you.
I have to go sit out in a field and think.
I know. We better get motivated here, Bill.
You've been listening to Mind Your Business on WABC Radio. I'm Bill O'Reilly. I'm joined here by Jessica Proud. We've been in here pinch hitting for Ira Saflis of Bottom Line Marketing. He's very kindly allowed us to guest host the show while he's away. We are from the November team, which is a mostly political consulting firm. We were guests on this show, and Yitzhak very nicely asked us if we could guest host it. We've really enjoyed it.
It's kind of fun being on the other side of the mic asking the questions.
And we had great guests. We want to thank again Matthew Glazier and Alex Gold. They were just terrific and really informative.
I learned so much listening to them.
We hope you'll tune in again next Sunday for another edition of Mind Your Business right here on WABC.
Thanks for listening and have a great week.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night from 11 until 12 for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Saflis has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he brings his business and marketing expertise to 77 WABC. Tune in to Mind Your Business every Sunday night from 11 until 12, right here on 77 WABC.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.